Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are former Southern District Prosecutor, Oklahoma City bombing prosecutor, Eitan Goldman, and author and Emmy Award-winning broadcast news correspondent Luke Russert. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the link to our sponsor, Hold On Bags, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsor. It really helps make this podcast happen. So please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. James, the verdict came down in the Trump E. Jean Carroll case. He was found in a civil action. He was found guilty of sexual abuse, sexual assault. He had to pay a $5 million defamation fine. That's a lot of dough. His lawyer said, well, he wasn't convicted of rape. Well, I marvel at that disingenuousness. The jury was quite convinced that he sexually assaulted this woman in a Bergdorf Goodman dressing room, and then he defamed her. And, you know, they couldn't reach a consensus convincingly on whether he penetrated. I'm sorry. This is a terrible decision for him. And three cheers for Ms. Carroll for pursuing this under what I'm sure was really, really trying circumstances. And James, I don't have any idea what the political fallout would be with this guy. I gave up trying to gauge that years ago. But I am aghast at some of his defenders. After the verdict, Marco Rubio of Florida said, this case was a joke. I have one question for Senator Rubio. Do you tell your daughters, Danielle and Amanda, that sexual abuse is a joke? So, James, I don't know. Where do you think it's going to go?
So, a couple things. I was out of pocket a good bit yesterday. How long was that jury out? I mean, they couldn't have been out.
3 hours.
3 hours.
Yep.
Well, that tells you everything. The other thing that was kind of interesting is there were 6 males on the jury, 3 females. How much does it hurt him? So far, nothing has happened. And I was having dinner in Los Angeles with a dear friend of the show, and I think one of the smartest political commentators ever, is Ron Brownstein. And he said that there's something we talked about, and it's called punctuated equilibrium. Now, that's a fancy Ron Brownstein phrase. It was in evolutionary biology that things just sort of happen for a long period of time, and then there's dramatic change. And we just have watched Trump's numbers stay about the same. If anything, at the indictment, helped him a little bit among Republicans. I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen. But it would not be unusual if one day he just had collapse is a word, but significant deterioration. And there's something we'll talk to our guest today, but there's so many other balls in the air. This is going to cause, it just has to cause some damage, some weakening, maybe it's be imperceptible, but there's so much more coming. I don't know. Like I said, you've always been of the view that he won't run, that there's too much out there. I was, then I wasn't. Now, every day I get closer to your view that it's just too much going on.
Well, James, this is an imperfect parallel, but I do remember 1973 and early 74 with Richard Nixon, and it really took an accumulation. What was that equilibrium that that Ron was talking about?
Go ahead. I'll get to it. It's called punctuated equilibrium.
Well, there may have been that.
And it was Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Elridge. The theory proposed that most evolution is characterized by long periods of evolutionary stability, infrequently punctuated by swift periods of branching, speciation, I guess, S-P-C-I-A, species. I don't know what to, I think I'm pronouncing it right. But at any rate, the theory being that things just happen at a thing, and then, but all of a sudden one day you have punctuated equilibrium, and that's the new big word for the show.
Well, that's what happened with Nixon. It took a while, but then his equilibrium was punctuated.
Yeah, now, whether his equilibrium.
Whether that's analogous or not,
we don't know, but we're on the punctuated equilibrium watch here.
Yeah, and if this case, I don't know how much it's going to hurt him, but if it helps him, there's something terribly wrong about us. It can't possibly help him. He was guilty. He sexually abused a woman, and he defamed her. There's no getting around that. James, let me turn to another subject, and I want to start with you on an ABC Washington Post poll last weekend that just ricocheted around the body politic. Your take.
Well, there is considerable and I would say justifiable criticism of some of the methodology in that poll, particularly the way that they asked the trial heat. And the headline, and people talk about it, and I saw there was a YouGov something poll showed, you know, Biden ahead of Trump, and the White House is obviously telling people it's an outlier poll, not a very good poll, and the trial heat number is flawed. I would say that I think the trial heat number is flawed. I think I just don't think that's where it is. But the problem is this is part of a long string of polls and 2022 election results. And I can't argue that this is justified, but it's a fact. His black approval is around 60%. We had terrible black turnout in 2022. That's going to tell you that we're not going to get black turnout anywhere where we need it in 2024 with Biden. The other thing that we see over a long period of time, his youth approval is not very good. Well, there's two secrets. In a presidential election, if the Democrats don't have a really good black turnout number or a really good under 30 turnout number, if they underperform, it's the most underappreciated rule. Everything has to add up to 100. So let's just say the expected under 30 number is 15% of the vote, 15 share out of 100. If it drops to 13, you say, well, that's going to cost you 2 points. No, it's going to cost you more than that, because if it's expected 15, and let's just say non-college white males are expected 30, well, if it drops from 15 to 13, that might go from 30 to 31. And it's a very, 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 very significant problem is Democratic enthusiasm. And that makes that case, as did the NBC Hart poll, as did the Pew poll, as every other poll that I've seen. And I've seen the election result. I'm very confident that that's the big, big issue here.
Yeah, I agree. Let me go back to the poll, because I, too, am very skeptical of the head-to-head that showed Trump 7 points ahead. I just don't think that's the case. And I think it was not a well-done poll. But some of the criticism is just from people who don't understand polling. One is the sample size, they say, was too small. Over 1,000 adults, 900 registered voters. I'm sorry. I directed over 300 polls over the course of, I don't know, a quarter century, done by the very best in the business, Peter Hart, Bob Teeter, Ann Selzer. That's the size we usually used, almost always. And at this stage, you don't do likely voters. You know, we don't know. People aren't sure if they're a likely voter. You do adults and then a subsection of registered voters. And to wait for anything other than race, gender, geography, or education at this point is really unnecessary and maybe even irresponsible. So I don't have any problems with that kind of methodology. And I think building on your points, I would make two, and that is the other polls are, this is not an outlier in general. Biden's approval rating may not be as low as 36. Okay, it's 40. That ain't much better. And most people, including a plurality of Democrats, simply don't want him to run again. And the White House can't run from that.
I think you're analysis was on point, sophisticated. I agree with it. I'd probably one minor, and this is very minor, but you're talking about waiting, which is very, very controversial. Age, sometimes you have to wait for.
I included age, I think.
You included
age?
I
meant to, at least. I mean, gender, age, region, and education.
Your analysis was accurate. It was sophisticated. And you're right. I would question the 36 approval number. I would question a 7-point trial heat in favor of Trump. But nobody does samples bigger than 1,000 adults. They had 9.
Well, some of those online ones do. That's what they kept citing. I mean, you can do an online 6,000, and you don't get any better result. You get a worse result, probably.
No, you don't. And in online polls, they go into them, and I think they're getting better. And better as a day goes. It's not a, we could talk about methodology in this, but the point is, the consistent point is Democratic enthusiasm, Black approval, youth approval are universally down. And that is going to produce a bad result. And it doesn't get any better. All right, so maybe we take our Ron Brownstein doctrine, which I forgot already what it was.
tell Brownstein he's just got to get down there level. I mean, we can't. He's too damn smart and sophisticated for us.
Punctuated equilibrium. All right, so let's talk about punctuated equilibrium. And this is what the White House would say. Look, Clinton got credit the first two and a half years for the economic recovery, but barred by 96. He's formidable force, won re-election easily. Obama, same thing, got no credit, got wiped out in 2010. We actually had much smaller majorities, had much more successful off the election. And, you look at even the inflation number today is showing some improvement. And it's going to get better. And, again, the hope is there's some version of punctuated equilibrium in the president's numbers. I understand everything they say is true, but I think it's unlikely to be the case. But it's demonstrably true that Clinton got wiped out 2 years in, so did Obama. It's demonstrably true by the time that they, in the last year of their first term, they had a, substantial improvement in their numbers. So, but I don't think that's the case here. And I think the analogy is factual, but I don't think it's relevant. But
agree. And we will undoubtedly return to this in the weeks ahead. James, our guest, is one of the foremost criminal lawyers and a fabled prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. He was a prosecutor in the Oklahoma City bombing, and now he's a leading Washington lawyer, Eytan Goldman. Eytan, thanks for being with us. I'm going to start off by asking you about Donald Trump, guilty in the civil case of sexual abuse and defamation, earlier indicted by the Manhattan DA, the Fulton County DA gives every indication of a charge is going to be forthcoming, while his own former Attorney General William Barr says Mar-a-Lago is the most serious, both for the offense and cover-up. That's before we even get to January 6th. Is there any connectivity, either legally, personally, or anyway, between all these cases?
The connectivity is the obvious one. It's, Donald Trump himself and his conduct that makes him subject to, criminal exposure and civil liability. So, it's not a coincidence that he's facing this kind of constellation of legal troubles. It's the bed that he made.
Yeah, it sure is. And I would guess, obviously, the case yesterday wasn't a criminal case, but we don't have any idea what effect it's going to have on voters, but boy, it's not something most people would want to have on their record.
No, it's definitely not. And, you know, one issue here is just the difference between the political timetable and the legal timetable. And that's something that the former president has, you know, used to his advantage for years, where he would, you know, sue to block the Congress from getting documents, or the courts from getting documents, or litigants from getting documents. He'd lose, he'd appeal, he'd lose, he'd take a cert petition up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, the wheels of justice grind exceedingly slowly, but the political wheels grind more quickly. So, you know, we could have a situation in 2024 where, if you, you know, believe the terrifying ABC poll from a couple days ago, Trump could actually get reelected while he's under indictment in, you know, three different jurisdictions. And in that case, you have a really unprecedented situation, because, you know, the reason that Bob Mueller didn't recommend indictment is because of the OLC memo, which says you can't indict a sitting president. But what it actually says is you can't indict or prosecute a sitting president. So he could, you know, actually at least delay his criminal day of reckoning if he, you know, if he wins re-election. And this is something that is kind of not there in the OLC memo, because I think until now it was inconceivable that the American people would elect somebody who had, you know, been indicted for serious crimes.
Yeah, you from your distance, I guess, at first I'd ask you, if you were Trump's lawyers, which one would worry you the most? But I also want to ask you about Trump's lawyers. He goes through lawyers faster than Henry VIII went through wives. I mean, he keeps replacing them. Some of your colleagues that I've talked to say none of them are the top tier lawyers. There's no real blue chip lawyer there. Is lawyering a problem for him, Eitan?
He has a really dizzying array of different lawyers. I mean, we are scheduled to take Mr. Trump's deposition in the Strzok civil case, and it has been difficult kind of pinning down who represents him at what time. But I mean, I think that there is a broad range of talents on his legal team. And one of his lawyers in the Alvin Bragg case is a guy named Todd Blanche, who is a friend of mine from the Southern District of New York and is a terrific lawyer and a good guy. So he may be an outlier, but there are a lot of different lawyers and of really varying quality and also, I think, varying ethical standards.
Well, that's fitting for Donald Trump. You know, any action, as you know, on Mar-a-Lago or January the 6th is going to ultimately have to be approved, if there is a recommendation, by the Attorney General. You know Merrick Garland well. He chose you to prosecute in Oklahoma City. Some hand-wringers say he's not tough enough to make those kind of really difficult decisions. What's your take?
I don't think he's going to be able to avoid making a decision. I mean, if Jack Smith comes to him and says, you know, we recommend that Trump be indicted for these crimes, you know, Merrick's going to have to give a thumbs up or thumbs down. And, you know, From everything I've seen of Merrick, he's a real, go where the facts and law lead you. And I think at the end of the day, he will, you know, approve indicting the former president if that's what the special counsel recommends.
James.
So, Counselor, I've been not a subject to my knowledge. I've been a subject of a federal investigation, but I've been on a periphery of some friend of mine here in New Orleans, obviously during the Clinton years. And the one thing you learn is they don't have to tell you shit. And then, they operate on their own timetable. But, you know, you can kind of read tea leaves a little bit. And Jack Smith interviewed Mike Pence. Would that be the kind of thing that would signal you that this investigation is likely wrapping up one way or the other?
I think there are other signs that this is a really mature investigation. Jack Smith actually has two kind of separate investigations going, right? He's got January 6th and the attempts to overturn the election, but then he's also got the Mar-a-Lago documents case, which, you know, is kind of more, well, it involves conduct that is more recent. And it's also more of kind of a headshot, because it's a much simpler case. You don't have to, you know, try to prove that when, you know, Trump was trying to get people to overturn the results of the election, he knew that, you know, the election was actually a Democratic election and that what he was saying about fraud was untrue.
So the Mar-a-Lago was, so for the record, I was a mediocre law student and to the extent I was a less than mediocre lawyer. But you, on your mind, you never can help when something is a criminal thing and you say, what's the defense? Because, I mean, I'm sure that you as a very experienced prosecutor and defense attorney, that's what you're going to look for. You know, I got these facts. What, you know, what's my defense? And for the life of me, and I've asked a lot of people, I'm going to ask you the same question. What's a non-laughable defense for the Mar-a-Lago documents?
That's a tough one, James. I mean, you know, I don't think there really
is. I've asked some heavy timber that question, and everybody's like, yeah. I don't know.
Here's the thing. What Trump's defense typically is a political or a PR defense, which is they do it too, or everybody's corrupt, or look, there were documents in Pence's house and Biden's basement and Hillary, but none of that is a legal defense. You can't
right,
go in.
Right. I understand you've kind of taken the notes and, you know, you got to think and, you know, exploring it. If they go to the Fulton County, I would say, look, he had no direct power over her. He didn't do anything to advance it. My God, there were 4 million votes. He thought there was 11,000. I mean, I don't know. It's a very good defense, but that would be off the top of my head. That's what I would argue.
I guess for the thing about classified documents is you don't really need to prove intent to violate the law. You don't need to prove that you knew that what you were doing was illegal. Although here, I think you definitely have that in terms of the, you know, obstructive activity and the lies to the government. But, you know, he could argue, I mean, he has argued, you know, as president, I had absolute right to, you know, declassify anything I wanted at any time. And I could even do it in my head. Right. And so I made a decision, which I didn't record anywhere or tell anybody, but I made a decision when I took this. By the very act of me taking classified documents out of the White House, I thereby declassified them. Now, as a matter of law, that's not true. But, you know, he could make that argument, I guess.
I guess. But even if the papers weren't classified, they didn't belong to him. So if you leave your law firm and you take your desk. I don't know what the situation is. Your desk, you know, the artwork, but just say it belonged to the law firm. Well, you can't take it with you. And they came and they told him, you have this stuff. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the National Archives. And he still didn't give it back.
Yeah. And then that's really, that's what's going to be tough, because the evidence of the, you know, him being told repeatedly, you can't do this. You can't take it. It's not yours. And then the, you know, videotape of him, you know, personally kind of going through the boxes and deciding what he wanted to keep. I mean, this is just a clash between Donald Trump's belief that he should be able to, you know, keep whatever he wants and say whatever he wants and do whatever he wants and the actual law.
Right. It's just like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, if you could take the, you know, Washington crossing the Delaware painting, I guess, and it doesn't belong to you. Quite simply, right. It's not yours. Your general point, your takeaway here is this strikes you as a mature criminal investigation that Jack Smith is conducting.
Yeah, no, I think it is in the end stages. And I think that, you know, it was a bad day for Donald Trump when Jack Smith was appointed, because he has been much quicker and more aggressive than what it seemed like the department had been doing for, you know, the first couple of years after January 6th.
Before I turn it back to Al, I gather you know Jack Smith?
I don't. I've never met the guy.
Never met. Okay.
But you know his reputation.
I do, yeah.
You know people. I know a guy that knows the guy.
Yeah.
And his reputation, I think you're telling James May, he's a tough hombre. He's a good prosecutor.
Yeah. No, he's got a great reputation. He's supposed to be, you know, fearless and calls him as he sees him, and aggressive in the right way, and great judgment. I don't know. You know, I haven't heard anything bad about the guy, from Trump.
Hey, Tom, let me ask you this. In this New York and the E. Jane Carroll case, the judge not only had an anonymous jury, but he warned them or cautioned them afterwards to stay anonymous, don't. Have you ever, you've tried a lot of cases, I'm sure. Have you ever heard of a warning like that?
Not exactly. I mean, I don't think the judge can force jurors to remain anonymous if they don't want to. I mean, if they want to go out and, identify themselves, there's nothing that Judge Kaplan can do. I think he was probably, giving them strongly worded advice because, he had well-founded concerns about their safety and, subject to harassment if they identify themselves. But no, I can't think of even in anonymous juries, I cannot think of a judge at the end of it saying, keep your identity secret. I don't know when that's happened.
Someone told me even in mafia cases, they haven't heard of that because the obvious implication is that you could be endangered because of Trumpites, if you will. And I mean, that's rather frightening, really. But let me move on to something else. You were an Oklahoma City prosecutor. There was a violent right wing back then driven by conspiracy theories, Waco and the like. Isn't it really much worse today? They spread this stuff on the internet. They have prominent politicians feeding it. Is the violent right-wing threat in America greater than it was, 27 years ago in Oklahoma City?
Yeah, no, I think it's immeasurably worse, way, way more dangerous. And, I think that for, Tim McVeigh, he had to find his kind of community of extremists and nut jobs by going to gun shows and talking to people and writing letters. But all you need is an internet connection in order to be able to, find some really dark places and to, engage in. I mean, and also I think the country is a much different place now. I don't think in, 1995, you could have had a president, tweeting conspiracy theories from the Oval Office. And we had that for 4 years, and now that same guy is, the leading candidate for nomination of a major party. So, just the division in the country and the polarization and the willingness of people to believe that their political adversaries are not just people they disagree with, but part of a horrible cabal of, child abusing monsters is just categorically different. It's really sad.
Frightening. It's beyond sad. Yeah,
it is frightening.
It's frightening. Let me ask you, before I turn back to James, let me ask you another Trump question. You have been in a lot of cases. You've represented people on both sides. And I know Trump's not normal, to put it mildly. But at some point, doesn't stress weigh in on him? I mean, some emotional toll of maybe being indicted multiple times and convicted of sexual assault, even someone as oblivious to normal human emotions as Trump, wouldn't you expect that there would be just some just gargantuan stress imposed upon him?
You would definitely think so. I mean, the process of being, a subject or a target or a suspect or a defendant in a criminal case, especially a serious criminal case, it takes a huge psychological toll. Most people don't enjoy it. And, I don't know Trump personally, but from my perspective, the thing that he seems to fear most and enjoy the least is just not getting attention. So if he's in the headlines, if people are talking to him like he matters, that may be more important to him than, what's actually being said. I mean, he may just have this fear of being, irrelevant that Trump's, to coin a phrase, that's more important than everything else.
So, counsel, I'm going to ask you like a polling question. I'm going to give you two statements and tell which one you agree with the most. Statement A, in the indictment of Donald Trump by the Manhattan DA for making payments to a porn star and ordering his attorney to put it out there, not reported as a campaign, blah, blah, blah. But while it might be a technical violation of law, this is something that we shouldn't be prosecuted with. This is not that big a deal. Statement B, it actually is a big deal when you do something at the end of the campaign, you circumvent federal elections law and have your lawyer do something else. Which is closer to your view? This is a, okay, but it's not that big a deal. You're damn right you should face the music for this?
No, I'm firmly in number two camp, James. I mean, I don't think it's as serious as, you know, January 6th or, you know, some of the other investigations he's involved in. But, you know, I do think that the deal with the National Enquirer and, you know, some of the – and, you know, obviously there were no charges ultimately brought for collusion with the Russians, but just the manipulation in the 2016 campaign – I do think that those are, you know, threats to democracy, and that, you know, this is a worthwhile case to prosecute. Again, I don't know that it's a crime of the century, but I don't think it is so hyper technical that, you know, the Manhattan DA shouldn't have brought it.
Yeah, I've never found an impressive way. You know, somebody gets stopped for DUI, and it's, look at all the goddamn murders going on. Why are you fooling with me? I mean, they're not related. I mean, And the argument just doesn't hold water.
There's
a lot of worse shit going on in the world, you know, and we shouldn't do that. But people do, and there was considerable, I don't know, pushback, but skepticism among, you know, non-right-wing opinion leaders that this wasn't that big a deal and it actually kind of hurts. And you don't share that view, I guess.
I don't. I mean, you know, I think that there's, you know, consternation because this is, people maybe see this as a little like Al Capone getting prosecuted for tax evasion when, you know, he's been responsible for the murder of dozens of people. And, you know, Trump's done much worse things than the Stormy Daniels episode. But I don't think that the fact that you have committed more serious crimes should, you know, immunize you or insulate you from prosecution from you know, less serious crimes.
Well, thank you, Counselor. I did love talking to you, and I hope I never need your services, but if I do, I'll call you.
Hey, James, I'm going to tell you something that we really share, a love for the Russert-Orth family. Tim was a dear friend, and every day when I watch the news, I wish he were here. He has been proven irreplaceable. Maureen Orth, a dazzling journalist, and every bit as warm, a great friend. And then there's their son, Luke Russert. He got his charm and smarts from both parents. He got his looks from his mother. Honestly, I have to – he's just published a book called Look For Me There. Grieving my father. Luke, shortly after your dad's sudden death in 2008, you joined NBC News as a young reporter. Now, you got the job because of your name, and then you earned it and became a superb journalist on Capitol Hill. I appreciate you pointing out that covering Congress is the best gig in town for reporters. It's a hell of a lot better than covering the White House. And you suffered some cheap shots, but I think the problem was something different, not per se going to work for NBC, but something that our family went through in a different way. You jumped right in and you never grieved, really, the loss of your dad. And reading the book was an emotional experience for me, as I care so much about you three. But it seemed to me this was the essence of the book, reporting on your travels around the world and finding yourself and better understanding your loss.
Well, thank you so much, Al. It's a real honor to be on with you guys. And for you listeners out there that might not know this, this is a little reunion of sorts for 6020 Sports, which had a great run on XM, Sirius XM Radio for 4 years from 06 to 2010. Although that show would now be called 7030. So, right, although we are forever 6020.
It's 80.
Yeah, it goes 80-40 soon enough. But what you referenced there, Al, in your wonderful introduction is the premise of the book, which is called Look For Me There, Grieving My Father and Finding Myself. And ostensibly, it's a deeply internal journey that happened over many external physical places with the diversity of cultures and whatnot. And what you hone in on is this question as to why I decided to leave NBC. There is this gilded path ahead of me. It seemed like there was limitless options. And it comes down to when I turned 30, I saw the light at the end of the tunnel a little bit more clearly. I lost a close friend at 27. My father passed away at 58. But I wasn't feeling fulfilled. And by chance, I had a meeting with House Speaker John Boehner, who saw me in the hallway and he said, I want to talk to you in my office. And I thought he was upset about coverage. As you know, we get dressed down often in the media by the people we cover. And I walked into his office. He said, well, what are you doing here? I said, well, you invited me to your office. What am I doing here? You invited me, right? And he said, no, what are you doing here on Capitol Hill? Because time's a flat circle here. You could be here till you're 50, 60, 70, 80 and not even know your life's gone by. Make sure that this is actually what you want to do. And make sure that this is something that is not too easy for you. You could do this job with your eyes closed. Is there another world out there for you? And that conversation ended up being a catalyst to listen to those voices in my head that said, hey, you know what? Maybe you got to go do something else. And when I left, it was only supposed to be about 6 months to a year of travel. I ended up learning through travel that I was doing two things. Is I was looking for something, which ultimately was a sort of acceptance by my late father to be my own person, but then I was trying to outrun something. And it's exactly what you honed in on. I was trying to outrun grief, because if I ever really processed the grief, then I would have to understand that he was really gone. And that was something that I had avoided for many, many years.
Well, the fascinating conundrum was, in a way, on these journeys, you escape the ghost of your dad, and in another, in finding yourself, you forged maybe even a closer bond.
Yes, and what's so interesting is that in all those moments where I'm alone, it's the sort of power of aloneness, you're forced to sit in those uncomfortable, heavy thoughts. There's nowhere to escape necessarily in the sense of, oh, I have all this work to do. It's okay, I'm at the top of the mountain. The climb is over. I'm sitting here. I have a moment to breathe. I have a moment to think. I have a moment to process. What's going in my mind, going through my mind? And it would constantly come back to dad, 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 dad. And that's when I knew that, oh gosh, I had never really fully grieved. And what would that entail? And what would that look like? And it took me some time to do that. What I did learn through the end of it, though, is something that, you know, Tom Brokaw has said a lot, which is that your parents are with you every day. You just have to look for the signs and you have to be willing to talk to them. But you have to get to that space, because for me, at least, it was, if I did that, then I would lose 22-year-old Luke. And 22-year-old Luke was the last, you know, time a kid saw his dad, who he loved so much.
Luke, it also is a love story between you and your mother. It brought you closer together. She was the adventuresome one in the family. She encouraged you. She encouraged your travel. And you know, the real Tim Russert, if anything, is even better than the legend. His kindness and compassion, as my family knows, is the equal of his professional brilliance. But your mom, Maureen, is just as special. And you really discovered that more in the journey, including when she traveled with you.
It's interesting. I had spent so much time traveling one-on-one with dad. We would go to Final Fours or spring training or political events, and it was the two of us. I was his little sidekick, and I loved it. But I had never had a solo adventure with my mother. And I actually really didn't understand who my mom was independent of that role of mom. And we had, you know, decent relationship growing up, but we certainly butted heads at times. She was more the disciplinarian in the family, the bad cop to my dad's good cop. But when I traveled with her for the first time, I understood that here was this woman at a very young age, 21 years old, graduated from Berkeley, did not want to become a nurse or a teacher, and decided to join the Peace Corps. She wanted that sense of adventure. So she measured herself up against the world at a very young age and really thought that that's what gave her purpose in life and really was a wonderful experience that gave her a lot of direction and ignited a lot of passions in her. She still runs an educational empowerment foundations in Colombia to this day. And I had never done that type of traveling. So it wasn't until I saw her out in the field and went with her to Latin America, saw she interacted with local people, saw how she went and sought out these wonderful local experiences and was never risk adverse, always tenacious, always tough. I then realized why she was so hard on me growing up is that she wanted me to be like that. She wanted me to be like her and to understand that, you know, nothing is handed to you. And it was a really eye-opening experience, and it ended up bringing us closer together. And I'm so fortunate I was able to have that. I wish it wasn't when I was 32, you know, 31, 32, 33, but I'm happy that it occurred.
Boy,
nonetheless.
I can imagine. You know, you're a great storyteller in this book. The baseball game in Hiroshima, escaping a coup in Zimbabwe. For James, the Huey Long Drive in Paraguay, and the people, the really interesting people. Do you stay in touch with any of these people you encountered, like that fascinating young French woman, Maggie, in New Zealand?
It's interesting. For a while, she was never she was not one to keep in touch. But for a while, I kept in touch with the surfer guy. I'd send him a few messages, and then the guy who I met in Easter Island. I want to look up. I'm desperate to find a young woman who is in my tour group. She was a school teacher in the UK, and she's actually the one who took the cover photo. I handed her my camera, and she said, "Oh, go off and walk there near the ledge in the Wadi Rum Desert in Jordan, and I'll take a photo." It turned out to be the one used for the cover, which is getting a lot of publicity now. I can hold up what the cover looks like right there. And I just want to send her a copy and be like, "Hey, that shot you took actually ended up working out really well." You know, some people, they keep in touch with everyone who they meet along their travels. It's easier to do now with social media. I still follow some people on Instagram. It's nice to see them pop up every now and then. But I'm curious to see if they follow me, if they know that they're a part of this book. I hope so.
James.
So, you know, Luke and I go back and think about 60-20 sports and the fun we had and just the different conversations. I guess one of the most memorable sporting events that I can remember was when we went to Baton Rouge for the LSU-Florida game in 2007. And, they went for it five times on fourth down and made it. And the other one that sticks out in my mind is right after your dad died, we had Senator Bradley on the show. And he said, "I'll stay on however long you want me to stay on." And I just never kind of forgot that, you know.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun there. I mean, that the tribute show after my father passed away was Yogi Berra. It was Bill Bradley. It was Bill Russell. Cal Ripken Jr. It was just an incredible assortment of guests, and that was so kind of you to put together back then. And then the game you're referencing, I believe, is the Tim Tebow game where LSU beat them in 07 on the Red National title. And it was my first time in Tiger Stadium. And the thing I remember a few things about that night, which was fun, is one, how at some point everyone just parks alongside the highway because the traffic is so bad to get in. They just say, screw it. And they park their cars alongside the highway, just start walking on the shoulder to get to Tiger Stadium. And there were more people outside of the stadium than were inside of the stadium.
That's correct.
And I believe I asked you about Louisiana and where taxpayer money went. And I said, is it really necessary for Mike the Tiger to have a $3 million cage or something? And you told me to shove it. So that was very funny. Mike the Tiger was a wonderful assortment of Louisiana taxpayer money.
Yeah, I just would say that I think the athletic department has enough money to pay for Mike's cage, but anyway, they get rent free land from the state. But so, you know, obviously you've had this terrific career. Well, the story about Boehner, you know, makes me like Boehner a lot more than I did at the beginning of the show. I didn't dislike him. He's actually.
He, as James is getting his headpiece on, I will say he has been probably the best Republican speaker in the last 25 years. Not a high bar, but he still achieved it.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of, Boehner prides himself, much like you guys did in that era, is there's something to be said about civility and being nice to people, even the ones you disagree with. And it's interesting as you bring up his name now and people look fondly towards it. There's almost a nostalgia for Boehner because it was sort of he was presiding over when the shift happened to a much more vitriolic, angry political time, especially which we live in now, which is just all memes and tearing people down, et cetera. It's tough sledding. It really is.
Yeah. You know, I see Barry Jackson every now and then, he's close to Mary and Maria Sino, and he was Boehner's kind of chief of staff. Barry's just wrought about the direction that Trump Republican Party is going, and I don't think my guess won't get better. But I just asked, obviously the question that people do is, wow, you had a great career on the Capitol Hill Reporter. You wrote this terrific book that's, getting highly regarded, well-reviewed. Can you give us any sense of direction? What are you thinking about your kind of next act in life? Are you in that thought process right now, or what direction are you thinking? And even more important, can you tell us, is maybe there's a girl somewhere along the line here?
I've known Luke Russer for a long time, and he's never been without a girl, James. So that's that. We know the answer to that. We may not know the identity.
Over the years, we go to a lot of national games, and as always, you know, I'd say one thing is
you at one time volunteered to pay for a New Orleans wedding for me. So that was, I don't know if you remember saying that, but that was once thrown out there. But that's funny, James, because, you know, look at you, you're a grandfather now, and you're asking the same types of questions that my mom is asking, is when are the grandbabies going to come? We're working on it. We're getting there. As far as what I want to do, I enjoyed the storytelling space. It's a good one for me at this moment. The book was a real, it was a long journey to write that. It took a lot of time. You know, you said to me early on in my career, you said, because a few people had approached me about a book when I was much younger, and you gave me advice that I always remembered, which was, you know, a book is expletive, 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 expletive hard. And I would tend to agree with that after having to write one. It was a very long, arduous process. I don't know if I have another one of those in me right away, but that long form storytelling, I really enjoy. And we have someone who we mutually like a lot is Wright Thompson, who does that show True South and writes a lot about stuff. And I like what he, you know, if I could be in that type of space, I think that's a very comfortable one.
Well, yeah, Wright would be a good guy to emulate, and he does a lot of long form stuff, and it's really good. And he's a very close friend. I text him every now and then. He's a Mississippi Democrat. I'm sure he's all in on Brandon Presley's campaign. You got to come down and see me in Bay St. Louis.
That's a place to be, I hear. You have a good time down there. I got to go do it. And we got to get you. Do you go to the games anymore, James? You don't go to a lot of the LSU games anymore.
I could park, you know, probably into the stadium if I want to. I'm lag directors around. But as you know, those things are a production. I don't care who you are. And when you drive from New Orleans, to go to an LSU game would take me 9 hours. All right?
Yeah.
And the television is just so good. You know, obviously, I went to the Clemson game in the national championship, and
But I agree with you. I think that now the TV value in HD TV, the way football is shot and framed, it really is a theater sport. It really is now. You know, it's much better at home. It really is.
You notice something about the LSU games that people don't appreciate? They are 50,000-60,000 people outside the stadium that have no intention of going to the game. None.
Right.
And they put the television up and they're balling crawfish and jambalaya and just drinking. And I don't know if that's true in other places, but I want to go to your sports. And where do you see the Bills next year? Are you optimistic, or they have issues coming up, or what?
My hope for the Bills is actually, I was excited that Aaron Rodgers is in the division, because I think the Bills would be much better served going into the playoffs as a wild card. I think that the last few years, they've tried to do this end-to-end, win the division, then go on to win the conference and stay at 13, 14 wins all year. It's very hard. Get into the wild card, have the odds stacked against you, and just play free-spirited football. And I think that'd do a good service for them. So I think they'll be okay. I actually don't think they'll win the division this year. I think Miami or the Jets will. I really do. But I think the Bills will get in as a wild card, and they'll make some noise.
Wow. Well, do you have any, like, prediction in college football?
It's not Georgia. How about that?
This is going to sound like really stupid. I think Georgia's overrated. All right? No, well, come on, James. Two-time national champion right in a row. They beat TCU, 60-4 or whatever it was. The two reasons I say that is, one, we were a good football team last year. I'm not going to kid, but I think Coach Kelly would be the first to say that we haven't come to be a great football team. They beat us in conference championship 30-15. All right, two touchdowns. Actually, they scored on, you know, football. You know, ball bounces off a kid's helmet and they get a field goal back all the way. We actually outplayed them. If you look at the thing, and Garrett Nussmeyer, but I mean, we're stunning at quarterback. And, you know, Garrett Nussmeyer is the best backup in the country. And people forget, everybody trashes the Big Ten and everybody trashes Ohio State. Georgia, Ohio State in the semifinal game was 42-41.
Well, they almost had them beat, Ohio State did.
Well, it's the first time I've heard of two-time national champions being overrated, but, you know, perhaps. Let me go back to Luke Russert and ask him this. You know, your dad was the gold standard in journalism, but he also was Mr. Buffalo, his hometown. You went back for a book signing, Luke. Did anybody show up?
Yeah, just one or two. No, we were very lucky.
Tell us about
it. It's a place called the Blackthorn Pub, which my grandfather, the late, great Big Russ, World War II veteran, garbage man, truck driver, worked two jobs, 45 years. He was a member there. And the Blackthorns are these old kind of Irish Catholic guys that wear the black top hats under the St. Patrick's Day parade, and they march with the Irish walking sticks, et cetera. So it was at his old Blackthorn pub and club, and a few hundred, I'd say about 400 people came out. The line to sign books went over 3 hours. So he signed a bunch of books. We took a bunch of pictures. Some people sadly had to get out of line because it was just too long. And I've been trying to talk to them and reach out to them and make sure they all got books. But it was a wonderful celebration of the book and also Buffalo. And I got to hear so many stories, but the one that made me laugh the most was this guy had rented a cabin off of Lake Erie on the Canadian side. And in the cabin was Tim Russert, 1971, that he had sketched in there with a knife. So my father at age 21 had gotten into some mischief at this cabin. It was sort of hidden behind a dresser. So that was a neat story. But it was a wonderful celebration of the book, and Buffalo has been so good to me. And, you know, we had a great week last week. It went up to number one on Amazon. It was number one on Barnes & Noble for a few days. And they actually ended up selling out of books. So it's a good problem to have. It's a little scary. But if your listeners, if you bought a book and the order wasn't processed right away, I can promise you it's going to happen this week. They got the presses up and running, so we're
and if you haven't bought a book, go to it right now. Go to Amazon or wherever you get your books and get Luke Russert's book. Immediately. You know, I remember you told me years ago one of the things that you considered was maybe going back to Buffalo, upstate New York, and running for political office. Have you ruled that out? Is that still a possibility?
Yeah, I think I've ruled that out. I mean, one of the things that you learn when you cover Congress is it is blood sport. And and it's only gotten worse. I don't think it's going to get better. I think one of the things we don't talk about enough in the United States is that because it has gotten so bad, the quality of the candidates on both sides has really gone down. Thankfully, there's still a few gems in there who come through with good records. But I think a lot of people, and this is why you see, I think, so many of the older politicians hang on. It's that the ones coming up the pipeline, it's not always the best and the brightest because so many people are just so turned off. And that's sad. And I think that's not good for a democracy. It's not good for civic participation because there are the forces out there that want you to be so just so over it that you don't pay attention anymore. And that's intentional a lot of the time. And that's not good. And my hope is that we get to a place where people realize how important it is to participate civically. I mean, that was one of the things my father was very patriotic about, was the participation and defense of democracy, that we are all in this as citizens here, and we have to do what's best for the country. And we are so very far away from that.
Look, I first met you when you were 2 days old. It was in the hospital. I remember your dad pointing out all of your great attributes at 48 hours, and his pride only grew over the years. And I think today, looking down on you, he's probably prouder than ever. But the other thing about him is he reached out to others. I know when my son was badly injured, there was no one there more than Tim Russert. So I guess what I want to say is just to you and Maureen, thank you for sharing him with all of us because he was – I've never known anyone more special.
Well, you're so kind to say that, Al. And as it was printed on his mask card – you know, there's no better exercise through the human heart than bending down to pick somebody else up. And he really, truly believed that. And just this past weekend in Buffalo, there were so many of those types of stories. People had said, you know, your father wouldn't know me from Adam, and he heard that my mom was in the hospital through the grapevine in South Buffalo and called up and sent us, you know, flowers and whatnot. And I have so many of those stories, and they warm my heart every single time. So thank you so much for that.
That's great. James.
Oh, well, no, I mean, I really, it was so touching to have you on the show, and I was so, you know, writing a book like that and exposing yourself and your feelings in this era is, you know, you got to figure that you might get some ridicule when you correct, you did not in Justifiably because you wrote a good book. And I just think that you continue to have something to say, and I hope you stay, you know, come back and be a little bit in the public sphere. I totally agree with you. I think Georgia is overrated. But I think it's good that you're thinking about more storytelling, because the more storytellers we have, the better we're all going to be.
Well, so, I appreciate that, James. Thank you so much. And you guys have been so supportive of me for such a long time, and I can't thank you enough. And you guys are great dads, too. You have great kids. Great kids.
I think Murray's going to see you tonight, so I ask good. About,
I look
ask
forward
about
to
Liam.
It.
Yeah.
Liam, Irish Liam.
I want to tell everybody out there, if you haven't already, I want you to get Luke Russert. Look for me there, Grieving My Father and Finding Myself. You owe it to yourself. It's a fabulous book. Luke Russert, we all are as, you know, we just, you know, revel in everything you are. So thank you so much for joining us. Okay, now for the outrage of the week. James, I'm going to postpone my outrage about Republican efforts to sabotage voting, and we'll start to take that up next week. Instead, I want to pay tribute to one of America's greatest citizens, Newton Minow, who passed away last weekend at 97. He is the most notable and prescient FCC chairman in history, extolling the potential of television in 1961, and decrying its entertainment fare as a, quote, vast wasteland, end quote. Over the next 60 years, no one contributed more to the advancement of communications, the public dialogue, and public television than Newt Minow. In his 30s, he was a confidant of John F. Kennedy. In his 70s, he was a mentor of Barack Obama. He and his close friend Abner Mikva were the liberal lions of the Chicago legal and political world for decades. I have never known a better public servant. He and his equally admirable wife, Jo, had three extraordinary daughters. The one I know the best is Martha, the former dean of the Harvard Law School and now the chair of the MacArthur Foundation. And on a personal note, he was the hero for my wife, Judy Woodruff, her biggest supporter and professional inspiration. She was blessed to have dinner with Newt a week before, and he was as sharp and wise and engaging as ever. A remarkable life for a remarkable American.
Wow. At MacArthur Foundation, those sons of bitches give out million-dollar gifts for geniuses. Why don't you give me a million? Shit.
Well, I'll talk to Martha about us, James.
So James wants his cut, you know? So every group, somebody is profoundly embarrassing a group. So if some Jewish person does something really stupid and you know, oh God, it's gonna be everybody, you know, or, you know, an Italian does something stupid, or a black person does something stupid, people within the group go, oh man, the person's a fucking embarrassment. Well, I'm a Southern college football fan, and there is no more embarrassing person in the world to my culture than Tommy Tuberville. He is the colossally ignorant jerk who doesn't even know, as a United States senator, doesn't even know the three branches of government. And yesterday, after Trump was found liable by a jury, he says it wants to make me vote for him twice. I just, when you think somebody can't be any dumber or any worse of a representative of the white Southern male college football fan, then Tommy Tuberville just exceeds your fucking expectations every time. So, Tommy, just shut up because you're embarrassing people like me. And you fit the stereotype. That guy is like, and he's the perfect storm because he's a giant fool and doesn't even realize it. I mean, a colossal fool. It's in addition to that, he's got really serious ethics problems, but that would surprise no one.
No, he sure does.
You touched on something that I want to go a little bit. I think most people know the producer of our show. He is famously a Brit and a dedicated and devoted anti-monarchist. And I didn't pay much attention to it, but I did, and I looked at some of the visuals. This thing is on the last leg. All right. I mean, I'm sorry. That guy looked ridiculous, 76 years old with a big old crown on top of his head. I they're not even powerful enough to get mad at anymore.
And you weren't taken, I suspect, James, by the new queen.
I actually, I watched the video of the coronation of Queen Elizabeth in 1953. And you had a sense that what they try to do is exude power in Pax Britannica and whatever shit don't exist anymore anyway. But he just looked, he didn't look intimidated. I kind of had some sympathy for him. And what's really amazing about modern Britain, and of course my family is famously Irish and, you know, of course traditionally hate the Brits for good reason. But I now feel sorry for them. They should wish they had anything approaching the economy in Ireland, and he just looks. Yeah, I don't think he's a bad guy. I think he loved horses so much he married one. It didn't like me. Said, look at this shit. They're spending all this money, and this is so out of touch with where the world. Hey, I didn't have it. My feeling was, shit, it looks silly. I think that was a lot of people. This thing.
I'm no fan of the monarchy. I do give him credit for being anti-plastics, but I think
he was a good environmental record. He actually. Is a kind of critique of modern architecture, which I believe kind of a reasonable thing to do. But I'm just saying, I doesn't have. If he were coming to New Orleans and I had to walk three blocks and somebody said, I can get you to the front, you can shake hands with the king, I don't know, man, it's too hot out there.
Okay, here's our favorite segment, one of our favorite segments, James. Questions, gosh, they are so good. I'm going to start with Bob in Tampa, Florida. And he says, you were with President Clinton when he made a political comeback and was dubbed the comeback kid in 1992. Ron DeSantis has had a horrible few weeks and is being written off as dead. Politically, if DeSantis were a political presidential stock, would you be a buyer or a seller?
Let's start with a couple of things. First of all, I cannot think of two people in politics that are stylistically more unalike than Bill Clinton and Ron DeSantis. All right? I was there, and the very qualities that brought Bill Clinton kind of back from dead or almost dead, were just the ability to relate to people in a stunning way and to do everything. And DeSantis, for whatever reason, I'm sure he has some kind of medical condition that he just can't relate to people. So he doesn't have that skill set, the analogy that you want to make. Can he come back? I mean, he's not dead yet. And a lot, and his sort of these cultural antics and stunts that he pulls are, sufficiently popular with the Republican base. And uh, I I would be reluctant to say he can't come back, but it's certainly not going to come back in any kind of way that Bill Clinton was able to.
Well, I think the only way he comes back is if Donald Trump craters. And yes. If Donald Trump craters, yes. Then you say, okay, if not Ron DeSantis, who? There's not a lot of great choices, but that's his one chance. But I share your views about him. He just is simply not a very attractive personality, and he ain't going to change that.
Yeah, the donors and people have like caught on to it. And the other thing is, sometimes something happens and it seems ridiculous and it's just politically damaged. And the pudding, eating pudding with his fingers. You know, one of my favorite people to cover this, is Margaret Hartman at New York Magazine. And she immediately said, this is the end of DeSantis. And I read the headline, and I said, oh, come on. Then I kind of read the story, and I said, shit, she might be right. I mean, of course, Trump seized on it right away. But I think that, you know, a little bit, when something that happens to somebody, it becomes kind of defining. And I think that did serious damage to him.
Yeah.
It seemed stupid, but it did.
We will see. Kristen in Orlando, Florida, says that 70 or 80% of Americans support red flag laws on guns or effective background checks for gun ownership, yet the Republican Party refuses to accept any of these measures. They may be softening a little bit in Texas, just a teeny bit maybe, but probably will come back. But is this simply about, Kristen asked, the NRA, or do you think on some level that they want their supporters to be heavily armed, including assault weapons? Yeah, Kristen, it's the NRA, but it's the rank and file, and there are other gun groups involved too. There is no every place in America, background checks, red flag laws, banning assault weapons, polls well. But what they do is they reach their people, they make for their people, the opponents of these laws, it is the top issue. And for the other people, the 70 or 80% that you allude to, it's, you know, maybe their fourth or their seventh or their 10th most important issue. And that intensity factor, sadly, has not gone away. And I'm not sure, I don't think Republicans are going to change much.
So, you know, there's a saying, and I think it applies to you, you can't unring a bell. All right, I'd never tire pointing out to people, assault weapons were banned in the United States from 1994 to 2004. I'm sorry, they were. And then we stupidly, and I mean really stupidly, did away with the assault weapons ban. And no one thought that the gun sales, the AR-15, and they have exploded. And everybody feels the same. There's this escalation that says, well, if everybody else has one, then I got to have one. And they're just... that they're prevalent, they're everywhere, and what in this the first thing where you have some kind of conflict dispute or you have a mental problem. Look, I think if you ran the thread through all of these mass shooters and this guy too, they're all none of them get laid. I'm sorry, it sounds kind of unsophisticated in a locker room analogy to make about a serious problem, but I bet you that if you put what's a constant in all of these people, that they're what they call incels, and they're just mad because they no one wants to have sex with them. I don't know how you solve that problem, you know, but that's a big, and this guy was crazy, and you know, and the fact that he, if they wouldn't have had AR-15s, okay, maybe he would have been pissed off and he'd have had a Smith & Wesson and started shooting people. He's not going to kill nearly as many people as you can with one of these things.
James Carville, a political maestro, an historical buff, and now sexologist.
That's right. I think that's my own research is that there are a lot of these people are just mad because they can't have sex with anybody. Yeah. They really
didn't. James, I want to combine to Dan in Los Angeles, who says that you say voting for no labels would be the easiest way for Trump to get back in the White House. But he said, what can we do about no labels? And would a no labels candidate, even given that ABC poll and everything, have a chance at winning? And then kind of as a follow-up, James, you can address both. JP in Virginia Beach says, okay, if you don't like Biden, give me one or two candidates who would be a strong Democratic candidate. So why don't you take no labels first and then go to the alternative?
Well, the only thing you know, so let's go with a little history. Ralph Nader clearly cost Al Gore Florida, which clearly cost Al Gore the election. Underappreciated thing is Jill Stein got more votes than Hillary lost by in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. You know, that's evident. And that's the kind of history. And so no labels would take, it's kind of putting out, look, we don't have any labels. We don't like Trump. We don't like the squad. I don't know what the fuck they're saying. And it's first of all, it's a giant money-making scam. Secondly, it's trying to get into contested states where all it can do, if it gets on the ballot in Arizona, is take votes away from the Democrat. And that's all it is. And what you need to do, if you know people that are donating to it, I had a friend of mine, a wealthy guy, Hollywood guy, asked me if I thought he should give money to No Labels. And I said, if you give those freaking people a nickel, I'll never speak to you again for the rest of your life. And if you don't call all your friends and tell them, I'll never speak to you.
Okay, quickly, James, give us one or two candidates who'd be better than Biden. Really quickly.
Gretchen Whitmer, Mitch Landrieu, Gina Raimondo, Jared Polis, Raphael Warnock. They're everywhere. Wes Moore, Josh Shapiro, Andy Beshear.
Our next question is from Tim in Bartlett, Illinois. So could you please talk about the demographics and voter aging death rates that may impact both political parties? And will gerrymandering continue to be a huge factor in making it very hard for Democrats to break through in 2024? Tim, let me tell you something. Gerrymandering is going to affect some House races. They're probably going to pick maybe Democrats are three or four seats, they'll have a net loss just because of that. But I'll tell you what worries me the most, and something that this show is going to start to focus on very soon, and that is absolute voting suppression. State after state after state that has a Republican control, Texas and North Carolina and Georgia and Ohio, are engaged in massive voting suppression efforts. It's Jim Crow 3.0, maybe, aimed primarily at voters of color, but also young voters. And what they realize is if it's a really fair election, oftentimes they're going to lose. And so they're going to make sure they tilt the balance. And I think James and I will start talking about that a lot.
A very good question. And, of course, 100% right. But the voter suppression stuff is an enormous problem. After this cycle, the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, Cleta Mitchell is, you know, very highly influential right-wing, I don't know, lawyer, agitator, I don't know what you call her, said, it's unbelievable. These college kids just roll out of bed and go vote. Well, why shouldn't they? I roll out of bed. All my life, I've rolled out of bed. And if I vote in New Orleans, I got to walk a block and a half to the fire station. What's wrong with that? I don't understand what they're talking about. Of course, we understand what they're talking about. They can't win elections unless they're suppressed. Now, the demographic question, I think some good quant or mathematician or actuarial guy could come up and, on average, how many Republicans die every week and how many people turn 18. And I think that has probably been done. And I suspect, I don't know, but I heavily suspect that there are more people turning 18 that are going to vote Democratic. And, you know, and there's a lot of Republicans who are dying. And they lost an inordinate amount of people to COVID, to the pandemic, because of the stupidity of not getting vaccines or wearing masks. And that's been proven, and a pretty big number. So, yes, and they know this is happening right in front of them. And they know the only thing they can do is voter suppression. And they better watch out. They could lose this race in Texas. I promise you. I think that Colin, you know, of course, we're big fans of his, is in many ways a better statewide campaign candidate than O'Rourke was. And Cruz is significantly less popular today than he was, in 2018.
I agree with you totally on Cowan. I'm not sure if I wish that other congressman had jumped in or not. He did jump in, and I kind of wish he hadn't. But in any event, I think Cowan will win, and he'll be a strong candidate.
I do think Colin will win. And I mean, I hear reports from Texas that people are very enthusiastic about him. And, you know, man, I don't know primary, but he'll win that primary.
James Ryan in Robeson County, North Carolina, says that Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who is a real right winger, is really putting in lots of work in rural areas. The local Democratic Party is virtually non-existent. What can North Carolina do? Because I have legitimately not heard of the Democratic candidate in my areas.
Well, you've obviously went to university in North Carolina and you stay much closer.
You're talking about me, James? I went to Wake Forest.
Yes. Right. Okay. I'm
trying. I see. Okay.
You have a greater interest, but my understanding is we do have that guy is really nuts.
Mark Robinson.
I mean, the lieutenant governor. Yeah. I mean, he's out there, even in out there, but, I hope that the Democrats are the candidate we have is the current attorney general. He seems like he's pretty on his toes kind of person. The fact that county, isn't Robinson County right out of Charlotte?
Yeah, it's down there. It's a swing county kind of
right. Right, it's a very, right. But the fact that you haven't heard what's going on is, I think, significant. And I will make some noise that we got to get in places like this and be heard.
But other than the presidential race and maybe control the Senate together, there is no more important race than that North Carolina governor's race in 2024. Because the Democrats screwed it up and they wrote off North Carolina, National Democrats, DNC in the White House, and they lost not only a Senate seat, but they lost the Supreme Court down there. So the Republicans control the legislature. They control the Supreme Court. If they control the executive, they're going to do a lot of damage in the next 2 years. If they get the governorship too, it's Katie, whoever you want, bar the door. It'll be an absolute – I mean, they will try to turn North Carolina into Alabama. It's a state that Democrats can win, and that gubernatorial candidate, I think it's Josh Stein. Is that right, James, the AG? He should beat Mark Robinson, who will be primary, but is likely to win. And it's a critical race. And national Democrats, the DNC in the White House, you got to put North Carolina on the radar screen of all the states that you lost in 2020. That really is the only one where you have a reasonable chance of winning next time in a normal race. You can't ignore North Carolina.
You can't, and I suspect that the previous question about the demographics, North Carolina, I would think off the top of my head, is a prime example of like a state where the Republicans are dying and more diverse and young. Not just we think of a lot of colleges there, but that's not who really young people are. And yes, I think, I think you're right. We got to get in there and compete. It's a lot of people. It's a huge, 14 electoral votes or something like that. And
I think it's actually 15 significant or 16.
State.
It is.
Okay, whatever. It's a lot, but it is a significant state that it would be very critical if we could get it to join the Democratic coalition. And with hard work, I think we can do it. But we got to get. Thank you for sounding the alarm. We got to get some work down there to Robinson County in terms of visibility.
Yeah, no question. John in Boston, Massachusetts asked a really good question. Why didn't the Democrats pass a debt ceiling extension during the lame duck session? It was obviously Republican obstruction was coming. They knew that. They wanted to. The calendar was so tight. They had so many other must-pass things that, frankly, and the Republicans in the Senate were going to be obstructionists, and they just couldn't do it, and they regretted it.
Yeah, this is, it always kind of works itself out. But I got to tell you, there's some chance this whole thing could blow up. I don't know. I can't tell you if the chance is 25 or 2 or 60 or whatever it is. But it's going to take some skill here. And I'm not sure how this movie ends. I'm really not. And frightening, is really
frightening. It sure is. I'm scared to death.
People are scared.
I agree.
You know, and you don't hear, you know, it's all going to be fine. It's just bullshit. You know, they'll resolve these things right at the end. Maybe that's the case, but I wish.
Yeah, as Luke Russert reminded us, John Boehner is not there anymore, and these people are no John Boehners. Tressa in Minnesota. Now, Tressa, next time you better tell us where in Minnesota you're from, because that's a pretty big state. But you asked such a good question. You say Mississippi is 36.9% black and 58% white, yet Mississippi is solid red. What's the deal? Are black voters not actually voting? Are they voting Republican or what?
So it might be a little higher than that, but it doesn't matter. It is by percentage the blackest state in the United States. And black turnout, black share constantly underperforms black turnout. But to understand this about Mississippi is that Jim Hood, Mike Espy, they lost by 5 or 6 points. It's not Tennessee. And, you know, I think they're really working. Hood and Benny Thompson didn't get along. I don't know. You know, I'm worried about black turnout everywhere. And I don't know why it would be better in Mississippi than it is anywhere else. But, I'm trying to help. And it's a state that Democrats can win, have a better chance to win statewide elections than they think. It just, when people hear Mississippi, they shut down. I never win. It's a backwards. It's you know, all of that. Some of varying degrees, all that's true. But it's a lot closer to being Democratic than Alabama or Tennessee or you know, Kentucky is. And I continue to believe that we got a real shot at the governor's race down there. And you just have to know how corrupt these Mississippi Republicans are. It's just staggering. So your point is well taken, and it's a very intelligent question.
Sure is, and I want to say right up front, my son's working down there for the Democratic candidate, Brandon Presley, in Mississippi. So I don't have any detachment at all. But I think James has made some really good points. There are two. I want to cite two pieces of journalism. David Firestone in the New York Times wrote a good piece about the possibility the Democrats really could win in Mississippi. So if you have any doubts, read that piece. But the other one is Mississippi Today, this little digital site that only began 7 or 8 years ago. Jim Barksdale gave him some money. Andy Lack of NBC News came down there to be, I guess, the chair of it. A guy named Adam Gatineau, I think I'm pronouncing the name correctly, is a wonderful young editor. And this woman, Anna Wolf, they won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting, for they were the ones that revealed the $77 million of welfare money for poor people that the governing Republicans took and handed out to supporters and contributors, including Brett Favre, for $5 million for a volleyball court at his alma mater. It was a terrible thing. And I just am so glad Mississippi Today was recognized, because they deserve it. It's a great place. And I would tell our readers out there, too, not only get the David Firestone piece, but start reading Mississippi Today. Maybe even contribute to them, because they're making a difference down there, James.
They are. And, you know, obviously I spend a lot of time in Mississippi because of my place in Bay St. Louis, which is just over the Louisiana line. And you're right. The Sun Herald, which is the, you know, Biloxi Gulfport papers, you know, doesn't have very much. I mean, I was struggling. The Clarion Ledger, the state capital newspaper struggles. I don't even think the Commercial Appeal is doing that well in Memphis in covering this. And it's all typical. Mississippi Today is far and away the best coverage of state government and state politics in Mississippi that there is. And you're very credible to point them out. And, you know, we'll see. But I do know that we're going to be competitive. And he had compared to other states, his fundraising quarter was better than we've ever had anybody in Mississippi. And it, I promise you, it's going to be a close election. I think Brandon can win the thing. I know that's my job number one between 9 November is helping
yep.
down there. So. Great question. Great observation.
That candidate James alludes
Small.
To is,
really good question.
Is Brandon Presley. That's a pretty good name in the state of Mississippi, I think. And also out there, start reading Mississippi Today. And then if you like it as much as I do, make a contribution to them. It's a terrific nonprofit that's doing, as James said, great, great work down there. So thank you. Keep those letters coming. We love those questions. I'm sorry if we didn't get to everyone, but if we didn't, we'll try to get to them next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. And don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Hold On Bags, in the show notes. We really thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.